Welcome to episode 242 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today, we're going to be looking at three very different ski resorts in three different countries, finding out more about Selva Val Gardena in the Italian Dolomites, Saint-Gervais in the Haute-Savoie region of France, and Murren in the Jungfrau region of Switzerland. Now, as well as that, we have our regular snow reports, the latest Team GB news, and your feedback. Now, my name is Ian Martin. I would like to introduce my guest today. Firstly, I'm delighted to be joined for the fourth time on the show and the first time since episode 207, around a year ago, by freelance journalist Katia Gaskell. Hi, Katia. How are you?
Hi, Ian. Really well, thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah, I did actually miss out. You did send us a snow report from Japan in episode 239. That was a bit of a special trip, right?
Oh, it was amazing. It was, it was everything we kind of hoped it would be and more. I mean, skiing that incredible powder snow in Hokkaido was, dream come true.
Cool. Well, we've covered Hokkaido on the podcast before, but maybe we'll have to have you back to talk about it. Tell us, where are you today?
I am in North London, where there is no snow, but lots of sunshine. So that's good.
Excellent. Okay. Well, my second guest today joins me for the first time since episode 70, when he was on telling us about the famous Inferno ski race. I'm delighted to welcome Alan Ramsey, sales manager for Schilthorn Cableway, the Murren Lift Company. Hi, Alan. How are you?
Very well indeed. Thank you. And it's also great to be back.
Yeah, you in the green room earlier, you just showed me the view out of your window just behind you. It looks pretty spectacular out there.
Yeah, well, it looks onto a building site. It's a building site in the valley at the moment, but it's right next door to our brand new station, which is taking a brand new cable car up via Murren and Baird to the Schilthorn. So it's a lovely place to be, and I normally come by bicycle from Interlaken, so I've got an 18-kilometre cycle to work, which is it's my therapy up and down every day. It's great,
right? Fun. Well, we will definitely be talking about that new lift a little bit later on, though. I have to ask, though, if you're doing an 18-kilometer bike ride every morning, is that an e-bike or are you under your own power?
It is an e-bike, but it does go up 300 meters.
Cool. Well, a brilliant way to start off the day. And starting off the podcast, I always like to ask my guests where you skied or snowboarded last. Let me start with you, Katia. We mentioned Japan. Was that your last time on snow, or have you been since then?
I've had quite a spectacular winter. I'm not sure I'm ever going to be able to top this season. So I've had some really good ski trips this season. My last one was last week, actually. I went to St. Anton for the first time and went with a group of friends to celebrate 50th birthdays, and it was brilliant fun. I'd never skied there, I had never done the apres there, and both delivered. So it was a really good trip.
I mean, I love St. Anton. It's where I learned to ski when I was younger. We have a snow report later in the episode from Andy Butterworth out in St. Anton. We'll hear what he has to say. What did you think of the snow conditions while you were there?
Look, it's definitely getting warmer. It definitely sort of felt like, you know, spring skiing. But we had snow overnight. So if you're up in the morning and there's a nice dusting of fresh snow at the top, the final rundown, sort of slushy moguls after the crazy kangaroo was always an entertaining experience. But yeah, we had some pretty decent snow where we were there.
You alluded to the apres ski. You know, famously, you've got the crazy kangaroo and the Moosava opposite each other on other sides of the piece. Did you try them both out?
Of course, you know, all in the name of research.
Okay. And did they live up to expectations and reputation?
Yeah, I mean, brilliant fun. You know, there was dancing on tables, there was lots of Europop, you know, rounds of drinks with sparklers in them. It was everything I'd heard about. Yeah, it was great fun, actually. It was a really good way to round off the season.
Yeah, it was in common with La Folie Douce, the dancing on the table. The music is slightly different over there, I think. Alan, let me come to you. When did you ski or snowboard last?
That was on Saturday, because we reopened the Schilthorn and I was up with a French journalist showing him around. But the weather turned out to be pretty good up at the top, and the skiing was lovely. But in between, when you got through the Canonagore on the Inferno course down that area, then there was incredibly thick fog And I think he was very happy to have me showing him where to go, because it was one of those, you, am I going up or down? Where am I? And you could lose your balance because you've got no idea which way the beast is going to go next.
I really don't like it when it's a complete whiteout like that. I have actually just literally fallen over before when you have absolutely nothing to be able to get any perspective on, and you just literally lose your balance. It's very strange. I was in, we'll come on to this later, but I was in Selva Valgardena last weekend, and yeah, the weather wasn't so good, not the sort of weather you would hope for the Dolomites, and a couple of times it closed in like that as well. But I mentioned Andy out in St Anton. We do have some snow reports, some of our regular snow reports. We've got Andy Butterworth in St Anton, Alex Irwin in Courcheval, and Ben Nyberg from Trizzle. So let's have a listen to those.
Hi there from St Anton, and welcome to the St Anton weather update. I say weather update rather than snow update, as there hasn't really been much snow of late. That's not to say the conditions haven't been excellent for skiing. Thankfully, over the last probably 5 to 6 week period now, the weather has been quite phenomenal. It's been blue skies, sunshine and warm days, and freezing cold, fresh nights and fresh mornings. So temperatures overnight getting to the minus 10, minus 12, which has been keeping the snow, particularly on the piste, in really pristine condition. So piste skiing for the last 6 weeks has been really quite phenomenal. The off-piste, not so good. We had a dusting of snow over the early part of this week, where it snowed on the Sunday and the Monday, which literally turned everything white again. So the piste again in superb condition. And for all those people that enjoy ski touring, the ski touring is fantastic. It's very safe because there isn't too much snow. So the off-piste skiing actually is quite good in the right places if you know where to go with the guides. On the piste, superb, really lovely skiing all around the Alberg. And that has been the saviour for this winter season, really. There hasn't been as much snowfall as usual years, but at the moment, the pistes are beautiful. The weather is stunning. More snow is forecast on the long-term forecast as we go into April and hit the Easter holidays. And in my 25 years of experience in St Anton, it always dumps in April. If you haven't booked for Easter yet, Easter skiing is simply the best. Get out here and enjoy it. Cheers, bye-bye.
Hi Ian, Alex from 150 Days of Winter with the Courcheval Snow Report for mid-March. After several weeks of spring-like weather, winter has returned with fresh snow falling. Some attribute this to Mother Nature. I, on the other hand, believe this is in part to Montclair, who took over the famous Altiport Airport in Courcheval to host a fashion show for next year's styles. Right on cue, it snowed 20 centimetres, giving that certain je ne sais quoi icing on the cake for their multi-million euro event. Two words, très Courcheval. However, for the rest of us mere mortals, this has revitalised the piste, making the snow conditions for the last month of the season just that little bit better. And there's more forecast to come.
Hi, Ben here from Ski Scandinavia, giving you an update on the snow and weather conditions in Trizil, Norway, and the wider Five Peaks region, the Stutten, Salen and Kleppen. Last week in Trizil, we had 20 centimetres of snow, which really freshened up the resorts. All lifts are open, and 98% of the slopes are currently open as well. It's sunny, and the week ahead looks absolutely fantastic with more sunny weather, and in fact, a high chance of more snow in the coming week to 10 days. Temperatures are very stable. Most of the day is around minus degrees, just creeping into the plus degrees in the late afternoon. Slopes are very well groomed and in excellent condition. Lots of corduroy skiing from the morning to early lunch, or as they call corduroy in Scandinavia, Manchester snow. Conditions for Easter look amazing, with, as I said, lots more snow to come, hopefully. Stable conditions, blue skies and sunshine. Perfect time to get away for the last skiing of the season. This has been Ben from Ski Scandinavia. Thank you.
And Alex referred to the Moncler fashion show. that happened in Courchevel. I was just reading about that this morning. Seems absolutely incredible. This huge structure that they built on the airport, the Altiport up there. And there were various people, or famous stars, including Anne Hathaway and Oscar winner Adrian Brody there as well. I don't know if Alex managed to sneak his way in. We'll have to get him to report on that down the track. Don't forget, if you want to help the Ski Podcast and save yourself some money this winter, all you need to do is use the code SKIPODCAST when you book your ski hire at intersportrent.com. Thanks to everybody who's used that code already this season. Quite simply, it helps fund the podcast and I appreciate it. So use the code SKIPODCAST or take the link in the show notes for your discount to be automatically applied. Now, Team GB news. Since our last update, a lot has happened for GB snow sports athletes. So I'm going to try and stick to the main points. Firstly, Luca Carrick-Smith, he took gold in the GS at the recent World Junior Championships. That is the first podium for Great Britain since Graham Bell finished second in the downhill in 1986. And it means that all three Carrick-Smith brothers have picked up golds in big events. Because last year, Zach won at the Youth Olympic Games. And earlier this winter, Freddie won at the European Youth Olympic Festival. And I couldn't be more pleased with these guys. It's been so exciting watching them coming through the ranks. And as regular listeners may know, the Ski Podcast is giving them some financial support. So I'm claiming in a very small way we're helping to with their progress. Next up, slalom skier Billy Major. He recorded his first ever World Cup top 10. He got a ninth at pronunciation, not sure about this, Hajfjell in Norway. Over in Telemark, friend of the show, Jasmine Taylor, she's currently leading in the overall sprint and classic disciplines. So looking like she might repeat her Crystal Globe win of last year. And in freestyle, well, we've got the World Championships on right now and into next week with a lot of medal prospects. Mia Brooks in the big air and slope style, Charlotte Banks snowball cross and Zoe Atkin halfpipe have already won Crystal Globes in their disciplines. But I was really pleased to see Kirsty Muir take her first World Cup victory in ski slopestyle last week in team. Now, you might remember she was Great Britain's youngest competitor at Beijing 2022. She pulled off the team's best finish with fifth in the ski big air. But since then, she's had a tough time coming back from injury. And I'm delighted to say that sometime a reporter for the Ski Podcast, Bethany Garner, caught up with Kirsty just after qualifying in team. So let's have a listen to that conversation.
So hi, Kirsty. Thanks so much for doing a quick interview for the Ski Podcast. If I can ask you a few questions. So we're here in Teen as part of the Mountain Shaker, which is two World Cups, big air and slope style. So today went well in slope style qualifications?
Yeah, it went super well. I managed to put a clean run down, which I was super hyped about. And yeah, qualified through to the finals, so I'm super stoked.
And any ambitions for the two finals?
I mean, I just want to put my tricks down cleanly. That's like my main goal. I mean, we've come in here with no expectations again, just super hyped with how I'm skiing at the moment and just want to keep pushing that.
Great. And can you just give us a bit of a lowdown about your return from injury, how the start of the season went and how you found getting back on snow?
Yeah, so I got back on snow in November and then back in the park in December. And then, yeah, straight into competitions in January, like a month after being back in the park. So, yeah, it's been pretty quick, but it's been a good process. We've like all worked together as a team just to make sure everything's good and, yeah, progress back to like what I've been doing.
And remind us of the injury and how long you were out for.
Yeah, so in January of last year I had ACL surgery, and then in March I had shoulder surgery just to fix an ongoing issue. So had a double rehab, which was like pretty difficult, but we did well with it. And then yeah, so it's been it was like basically a year. It was like 11 months till I was back on snow, but a year till I was back in the park.
And was it hard to keep positive, or did the rehab kind of keep you focused?
Yeah, it was a lot of rehab, like in the gym 5 days a week, so that was like good to keep me focused. I managed to do like a few other cool things, which was cool, but like it was always just thinking to when I'd be back in snow and like, how excited I was. That was what kept me going.
And do you feel generally pleased with your comeback?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we had no expectations, and like I feel like I've been riding really well, which I'm stoked about, and making a few finals has been a really good cherry on top.
Okay, and as we kind of come out the end of this season into next season, what are kind of next goals, and are we already thinking Olympics?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we're in the qualification period right now, and like I'm doing pretty good for my points and things, so that's exciting. And for like the summer, I want to learn some new tricks, and then yeah, going into next year, the World Cups, X Games, Olympics, just try and put some really cool tricks down and see how well I could do.
Now I'm going to ask you a horrid question. Mm-hmm. If you had to choose big air or slopestyle?
Oh my god, it's so difficult because I love them both, but probably slopestyle because of the, I love the creativity involved. I feel like not many people have the exact same run. Like I think I love rails coming from the UK. We do a lot of rails, you know, from the dry slope and the dome, and then like the combination of that to the jumps. I mean, a lot of people do their big air tricks in the slopestyle, so like I think I've got to say slopestyle, but that is a tough question.
And could you just give us a little bit of insight into kind of your life on the road? Are you like hanging out with the other GB athletes, or is it just you with your kind of crew, physio, coach? Give us a little insight.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends like where we are. Like in competitions, like we quite a lot of the time stay together, but like right now there's 7 of us in the same house, like the other lads, coach, physio. So yeah, we hang out like a decent amount, and then like traveling, sometimes I'll be on my own, sometimes I'll have other people around. Like it really just depends, but a lot of the time we travel as a team.
Great. Quick question, I know you're only 20, is that right? Not quite a veteran yet, but already we've got younger guys and girls coming mm-hmm. through.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you have an influence them on them? What's your kind of feeling about that next generation?
I mean, I think, yeah, the next gen, they're coming through and sending some really sick tricks. I don't know, I just, like, when I was younger, I felt that, like, the other girls really welcomed me in, and, like, we're all about having a good time together and supporting each other. So that's all I'm trying to do for them, just, like, make sure that they're enjoying themselves on top of all the pressure and nerves that might be going around. And just, like, yeah, I mean, we're all good friends, and I just hope that they feel included as well.
And do you know Sandra Korn, is it, who mm-hmm. won 2 medals at the youth?
She's from the same dry slope as me, so I've like seen her since she started, like since she started freestyle. I can't remember how old she was. She was like young, but still like older than some people start, and she like was just a sender from the get-go, and she's like super sick and been doing some really cool stuff, and I'm excited for if and when she comes on the circuit.
And do you stay in touch with her? Did you send her a message after her medals?
Yeah, absolutely, and we talk pretty much every day. Like I know like it's pretty like old, but she's like the only person I've got like a Snapchat streak with, because we talk all the time, and she's just always hyped. And I mean, today she qualified for the Europa Cup final in Lax, and she was hyped on that, and I was hyped on that, and she was hyped on me qualifying for the finals here. So we're always like, we're always chatting to each other.
Great, thanks so much for your time, Kirsty. Thank you.
Kirsty mentioned Sandra Cohn, who won 2 medals at that same European Youth Olympic Festival that Freddie Currick-Smith won his gold. So it's very exciting time for GB Snow Sports. We're less than a year to go until the Milan Cortina Winter Olympics. If you'd like to know more about Kirsty, I did a special interview with her in April 2023. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Right. I mentioned I've just come back from Selva Val Gardena in the Italian Dolomites. I cannot believe that I have never been there before. And just to try and give you some perspective, Val Gardena is the valley. Selva is the highest village in that valley. It's pretty high, 1,563 metres. I travelled there and back by train. Regular listeners will know that that's my mode of transport for the last couple of years. I've covered the European Sleeper before. That's who I travelled with in episode 237. I'm delighted to report they solved the problem they had with their inaugural departure. No need to change trains down Innsbruck. So I'm not going to go into that train in detail. Just listen to episode 237. Others say it's all about the journey. 6 countries in 24 hours. Really is quite amazing. And the community on the train, like-minded people, very friendly, very sociable, very safe.
Yeah, so where does it go? So obviously you leave London. Where does it go through?
Yeah, well, you go from London to Brussels, and then it goes Brussels, loops up through the Netherlands, and then comes down through Germany into Austria, Innsbruck, and then into the Dolomites. And actually, that train continues down to Bolzano, Verona, and goes on to Venice. So most of the people on the train were going on short breaks to Venice, but there were quite a few people skiing in, going to Austria to ski and going to the Dolomites to ski as well. And a few people getting off kind of early in the morning in Munich.
Nice. And did you have a, was it sleeper? So it was like berths for sleeping?
It was couchettes.
Couchettes, good.
I don't know if you've done the couchettes. We booked into couchettes for six. On the way out, there were four of us. On the way back, there were five of us. I think probably my best way of describing it is, you know, if you don't like camping, you probably won't like traveling in a couchette. If the sort of person who doesn't mind camping, then it's fine. And, you know, obviously very low carbon way of traveling, but just it's all about the journey, you know, that side of things.
Well, it sounds a lot better than the overnight train that I took with my youngest to Moutier, the sort of snow train that is essentially just a train that travels overnight and you sit bolt upright for the 12-hour journey. So I think the couchette sounds quite comfortable.
For sure. I mean, I have done that one before and reported on that. And I think, you know, a lot of people kind of lie down on the floor, but the overnight in sitting up, which you can do on the European Sleeper as well for a significantly discounted cost. But I would go for the bed myself. Looking onto Selva, though, I mean, firstly, that is a great ski area. 175 kilometres, I think, in Selva Valgardena itself. And on the first day, I went with a guide, Gunter Costa, and explored the legendary eight. And these are eight peaks around the Valgardena area. It takes you all the way around, including San Cristina, and you go down to Ortizai. They've got one run off Ortizai, which feels like it's probably only been added in as a way of like a political compromise between everyone to get you to go down there. We had to walk across town. But to be honest with you, I actually quite enjoyed that because it gave you much more of a sense for the area. And Ortizai is a bigger town where locals live. That was great. Katia, I think, I know that you were in Valgardena around a year ago, did some of those legendary eight runs. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I went about this time last year, actually. I went with my dad, who was just about to turn 80, so he is still skiing. Neither of us had ever skied in Italy, and we, like you, kind of arrived in Valgardena and thought, how has it taken us this long to get here? It was just the most spectacular destination. I mean, you just cannot compete with the backdrop of the Sassolungo. I loved it, and my dad did too. We just thought it was such a great resort, really good skiing, and we did a couple of those legendary eight runs as well.
I have to say that you know, I thought it was great. I only had fleeting glances of the Sassolungo and the other mountains in the area. And even that was enough to be extremely impressed. I mean, I think one of the reasons a lot of people go to Selva and go to the Dolomites is to do the very famous Sella Ronda. And I did that on the second day, taking the green route. Effectively is incredibly well signposted. You can either go on the green route, which I think is the anti-clockwise one, or the orange route, which is a clockwise. And there's, you know, slight differences between them. I think the route I took, you ended up taking four lifts in a row right at the end, which is a little bit boring, that final bit. But it is so well signposted. It's very easy to follow. And from Selva, you end up going via Araba, Val di Fassa, Altabadia. I think I looked it up. It says it's 44 kilometres of long and 23 kilometres apiece, which doesn't feel like that far, but it's definitely a big day out. And there are lots of different side routes that you can do along the way. You know, so much to discover. It feels like it's bigger than an area like L'Etoile Valley, although I think the number of kilometres apiece, if you add them up, isn't bigger. But it's just spread over like a larger physical area. Katia, did you do the Sella Ronda?
I did. I actually did the other way around. I did the orange route. Yeah, because you have slightly more time on the piece than in the orange route than on the green route. So I opted for fewer chairlifts. Yeah, and I know what you mean. It does sort of feel bigger. And I wonder whether it's because you're really following a trail rather than just sort of skiing routes. I took a detour and went down to, I'm going to pronounce this really wrong, Malga Chiappella, where you can get the sort of trio of cable cars that takes you up to Marmolada, which is the queen of the Dolomites. And, you know, I was really lucky. I had this most beautiful weather when I was there. This is sort of 3,200 odd meters. And so you have these wonderful views. And then kind of, you know, skied down. I was like, right, I need to get back on the route to sort of make sure I get back in time. But it's a really fun way to discover that area.
For sure. I really enjoyed it, you know, as a tour, and I really enjoyed the way the ski area linked up as well. And I would stress that, you know, as most people might guess, in Italy, the food was excellent. There are a lot of mountain restaurants and mountain huts, you know, excellent prices, really good quality food. Most of them are family run, like Dreisinnen, which I covered in episode 237, a bit further north in the Dolomites. And when I was in Val Gardena, I spoke to Christina Demetz from the Val Gardena Tourist Office about some of their sustainability goals as well, and also about the trend in the number of North American guests. So let's have a listen to that. Coach, I'm here right now with Christina Demetz from the Val Gardena Tourist Office. Hi, Christina.
Hi, nice to meet you. If I want to salute Pladin.
That was Ladin, yes. Was it? We were just saying, actually, how in this particular part of South Tyrol, people speak three languages, right?
Yes, we are officially trilingual. We speak Ladin, German and Italian.
Yeah, and in your case, speaking English very well as well.
I hope you understand, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And we were just talking about a few things in relation to the resort. And, you know, I arrived here by train today. I took the European Sleeper, the overnight train, and arrived in Port Gardena is the name of the resort. And you're explaining to me South Tyrol has a goal of being carbon neutral by 2040, and one of the things they're doing there is to make public transport free for people, and you can actually get a bus directly from Port Gardena to Val Gardena.
Yes, also from Bolzano train station. Also, you can take the buses here in South Tyrol, and then what brings you for free to Val Gardena and back, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. It's a half an hour journey, but I think you often find when people take the train, they're a little bit worried about how to do that final bit of it, and that just makes it so much easier. As well. And I noticed there's an electric charging point just down the road there, and you're bringing in more electric bikes. So lots of things there. In fact, the resort got an accreditation. I think it's a United Nations accreditation a couple of years ago. The GSTC.
GSTC, Global Sustainable Tourism Council.
Yeah.
That's a global and international certification for sustainability.
Yeah.
And we work very hard on this stuff and on these things. And one was also this public transportation. Yeah.
Yeah, and there are a lot of things there. You've got various policies. You're putting in like more bike paths and trying to get less traffic on the roads as well.
True. Yes, we try to keep the valley a bit more car-free.
Yeah.
Possible. So the guests they stay here in Val Gardena. They can also take all the buses in the valley. Even in summer, this is very interesting. So you can start to make your hikings, and then you must not go back where you started because of your car, you know. So it's interesting.
Yep.
Because the valley is very well connected by lifts and buses and walking path.
Yeah.
So you are free to do all.
Yeah, well, I haven't actually skied yet. I'm going to start my skiing tomorrow. I'm going to start off with the Legendary 8.
Yes.
And I'll be reporting on that in the podcast, and I'll do the Celeronda as well. But I was interested just to talk to you. You mentioned earlier this season you've seen a lot of international guests, and obviously you get a lot of British guests coming to Val Gardena in the Dolomites. But it's part of the Icon Pass as well, isn't it? So if you have an Icon Pass, you can ski in the Dolomites. Have you seen more North American guests coming here?
Yes, the last year or more and more. It's because of Icon Pass, probably.
Yeah,
yeah. And we have a lot of a big increasement of of American people, and they normally they say they come here because it's more convenient for them to come to the Dolomites than staying in the USA.
Yeah, I mean, I think people who live on the East Coast, you know, you can fly to Europe, and then the dollar's pretty strong right now, so it's pretty inexpensive. But I think, you know, it's also, I've got to say, I didn't ski today, but my wife did. And she said to me, oh, she bought, you know, three coffees on the mountain, and it was only €7. And she couldn't believe it, because when you're used to skiing in France, that is really good value.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, we have a lot of huts, you know, small huts on the ski slopes, and this makes this area surely very beautiful. Also, it's not just for the beautiful panorama and surroundings and the beautiful mountains, but also because we have these small huts everywhere. We have just in Val Gardena we have 60, and these are all run by families from here. So you can have very good food from South Tyrolean food, but also Italian food, of course. We have this mix, but it's all very traditional.
Yeah.
And good cooked and served by the table. So
yeah.
You can relax and have a good time.
Yeah, there's definitely that sense that all the businesses are family owned and run. And I think that's really a key part of any holiday in the Dolomites. But that is brilliant, Christina. Mille grazie, or how do you say that in Latin?
De gras.
De gras. Zigra. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I loved it. Until this winter, I'd never been to the Dolomites. So, Katia, I can't believe you've never been to Italy at all. You know, I wanted to go to Italy more this winter. I felt I hadn't seen so much of it. And in fact, this winter, I've managed to go to Courmayeur and Dreizinen and Val Gardena and the Lascine in Sicily as well. So I've got my fair share of Italy this winter, but I will definitely be going back to Selva Val Gardena. But I'm going to check the weather forecast first because I want to get all of those views. Now, Katia, I travelled by train to Italy. I wanted to have you on the show today to talk about Saint-Gervais in France. But I think that when you went there, you travelled by train. Is that right?
I did, yes. Yeah. So we took the Eurostar to Paris and then changed to the Gare du Nord and then took, well, it depends what, on certain days, there's a direct TGV train that takes you down to Lafayette, which is the train station for Saint-Gervais. So super easy trip and yeah, really comfortable. And I mean, I'm a big fan of train travel as well. I would do it more if it was more affordable. So, but it's it was a really, really easy way to travel across France.
I mean, you say more affordable. I mean, such a defender of train travel, and I'm also quite experienced, and I've booked a lot of train travel. And for example, I'm actually going to Saint-Gervais-Lafayette in August. And I noticed that there was a sale going on at the moment. And I've actually only bought my ticket to Geneva, but it cost me €25 to go from Paris to Geneva. Now, when I add on the extra bits in between, it's probably going to cost more than flying, but it's still, you know, taking another, you know, 30, 40 euros off the total cost. If you're ready, you know what dates you are, you're in the right place. And you know, I booked my Eurostar as soon as they came out ages ago. So I'm paying €49 each way, £49 each way for the Eurostar. You can minimize it. However, the reason you went to Saint-Gervais was, I think, to look at a new lift that they've had, which I can't remember if we've mentioned it on the podcast before. I don't think we have, but it's very interesting. It's a massive development. And, you know, that has an environmental theme to it as well. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So it was my first time to Saint-Gervais, which is quite funny because I spend quite a lot of time in Morzine, which is not that far away. But Saint-Gervais, so in the Haute-Savoie, it's not that far from Chamonix, 2 hours by train from Geneva. And it's built on sort of various levels. And Lafayette is in the valley, about 580 meters. And in September last year, they built Le Valin Gondola, which is a 10-person gondola lift, which links the valley floor up to Saint-Gervais, the town, which then links directly to the gondola that takes you up to the ski area, which is the Evasion Mont Blanc ski area. And the lift, I mean, it was 45 million euros. So it was a big investment, but it was done to just facilitate ease of transport. So it wasn't done necessarily for skiers. The mayor of Saint-Gervais is very much a locals first mayor, and all development is done with locals in mind. And so this was this lift was really built to ease traffic, reduce carbon emissions, and just make the sort of flow of travel that much easier. So it's currently free for locals to use. Kids use it to get to school, people use it to get to work. And we stepped off the train in Lafayette, jumped on the gondola, and you know, we're in our hotel and ready for dinner in no time. So yeah, it's a very cool initiative.
And just to you know, help people listening understand, You talk about where you come in on the train. Is at the basically the end of the valley, just before you go up to Chamonix. But Saint-Gervais itself is kind of split into two levels. There's two different towns, aren't there? Which is one of the reasons this has been put in. You talk about people going to school. There's a road connecting them. And previously, a lot of traffic going on that road.
Completely. And so, yeah, it's sort of a series of tiered communities, I suppose. And so this gondola links that sort of valley floor at 580 meters to Saint-Gervais town at a sort of 300 meters higher, and has just really reduced time in cars and buses, and just eased that sort of traffic flow. It's you kind of think, oh, that seems like an enormous project just for 300 meters, but it has really transformed the way that people sort of move around the town.
And Saint-Gervais itself, I have a few friends who live there. I think it's quite a big British community in Saint-Gervais. But you can actually ski quite a wide area. I mean, you referred to the Domaine Vasier Mont Blanc, but you can ski over to Les Ouches from Saint-Gervais. You can ski over to Megève from Saint-Gervais. They're all connected, essentially, aren't they?
Yeah, so you've got the Domaine, the Vasier Mont Blanc ski area is sort of 400 odd kilometres. And that includes sort of Megève, Les Contamines, Combloux, Saint-Nicolas de Véros. Yeah, so you have access to all that. And there's a really nice variety of skiing, you know. And then you also have access to Les Ouches, which you travel to via the Mont Blanc tramway. It's been taking mountaineers up there since 1909. And so we spent a day skiing the Domaine Evasion Mont Blanc, and then we spent a day in Les Ouches. And it was really fun, actually, to see the difference. And Les Ouches is quite a small area by comparison, sort of 55 kilometres of runs, but there's lots of trees, sort of pine and larch forest. So it's quite a popular spot if the weather's not great. And it also has this wonderful run, La Verre, which is a sort of 3,300-odd metre-long World Cup downhill run, which was a lot of fun. And because it takes a little bit more effort to get to, that area wasn't nearly so busy. So, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, long-time listeners will remember I was out at the Kandahar slalom race last year, I think it was, which is at the bottom of Les Ouches, where they alternate between slalom and downhill over there for the Kandahar races in Les Ouches. Can I ask a question? There's a Folie Douce at the top of Saint-Gervais. Did you go to that at all?
Do you know, we didn't. We were all so keen to just keep skiing. It was going off at La Folie Douce on the afternoon that we were there. But we were really enjoying the ski area. And we were lucky we had bluebird days when we were there as well. Beautiful views of Mont Blanc. Yeah, we just sort of cruised around on skis and left other people to do the dancing on tables.
Katia, I need to be going on holiday with you. You had perfect weather when you went to the Dolomites. You had perfect powder when you're in Japan, and perfect views of Mont Blanc in Saint-Gervais. It sounds like you've definitely been lucking out. You might not have been dancing on the tables, but I think that also something else that Saint-Gervais offers that maybe you don't see in so many resorts in the French Alps, in the Pyrenees for sure, but they have a thermal spa there as well. Is that right?
Yeah, they do. And what's really interesting about Saint-Gervais, and one of the reasons I really liked it, was it's still very much a local town. You know, I mentioned the mayor, really, developments are very much done for the people who live there. You know, compared to some alpine towns, you know, they have been just overdeveloped and without much thought for sort of infrastructure. But Saint-Gervais sort of feels very... that it's been well maintained and well thought out. You know, it's long been a popular place for mountaineers because of Mont Blanc, and then also for the thermal spas. And so these waters, you know, they sort of flow from the mountain at sort of 39 degrees. And I mean, the first thermal bath as a destination opened in 1807. And they've got this incredibly rich mineral content, which is supposed to be great for skin ailments. And over the years, it's been sort of developed, and it's now this sort of really nice spa that you can go to just to sort of relax in the outdoor pools and saunas. But they also do treatments, and the water is particularly good for some burns. And there's a story of a famous dancer, French dancer in the 1960s called Jeanine Charest, who her tutu caught fire and sort of 70% of her body was covered in burns. And she went through ongoing treatment at the thermal spa and was treated well enough that she could dance again. I'm not sure professionally, but she quite extraordinary, this wonderfully healing properties of the water.
Okay, and it's open to the public. You went and tried it yourself?
Yeah, open to the public. And there, again, it's sort of on the valley floor. So the way that you access it now from Saint-Gervais is by a new lift, which opened again recently. Yeah, it's essentially an elevator that goes down the mountain, but it's powered by wastewater and is free to use. So it's another really cool eco-friendly initiative that has recently opened.
Yeah, and I've got to ask one more question about the mayor. I have mentioned I have friends who live in Saint-Gervais, and I know that the mayor there is quite outspoken. He's not afraid of falling out with some of his neighbours. He had a dispute with Megève a while ago in relation to the routing, I think, maybe, of the new lift.
Yeah, he's he's quite strident in his views. it's very much Saint-Gervais for the people. So seems to be working well.
Oh well, that's brilliant, Katia. Thank you very much for that. If it's okay, I'm going to move on to Alan now. Alan, you were last on the podcast for our Inferno special. That was episode 70. That was a long time ago now. It's a brilliant, unbelievable race that I was lucky enough to take part in one year, and something that I'd definitely like to try again. But listeners might not realise about the long history that Murren has and the connection with Britain. I wondered if you could just give us a little bit of an insight first into, you know, how Murren and British skiing has crossed over time.
Yes, of course. Well, the prisoners of war during the First World War were often interned in Murren. So there was also British officers here. Kandahar Ski Club was, of course, formed in Murren in the Hotel Murren Palace, which has just reopened after 15 years of being closed. So they formed the Kandahar Club there in 1924. So we celebrated 100 years last year.
What's interesting, I mentioned, I was at the Kandahar races in Chamonix, and maybe listeners might not realise that that is all connected. It all comes from that original Kandahar Club formed in Murren.
Exactly. But it was also the Kandahar Arlberg races. So it was Sir Arnold Lunn in Murren and Hannes Schneider in Arlberg, who came together and formed these races, which were taking place in Murren for a long time, unfortunately no longer. So it also led to the first ever world championships in skiing were held in Murren in 1931, plus the second ones were held in 1933.
Right, okay. And you mentioned, I think, Arnold Lunn just then. Most people would think of him, I think, as the inventor of ski racing. I mean, the British invented alpine ski racing. When I've reported on the 1924, the first Winter Olympics in 1924 in Chamonix, there was no alpine ski racing at the time, even though Britain or Sir Arnold Lunn had already started racing. Is that right?
Exactly. In 1922, on the 21st of January 1922, Sir Arnold Lunn held the first ever slalom on the slopes around the Almond Hubel funicular train, which is now 113 years old, the train. And it was the British who encouraged the locals to open the Almond Hubel train in the winter because it was only a summer opening that they had at the time, and said, we want to help with our skiing, which then led to the first slalom being held there. Exactly.
Oh, and just to go on an aside, Alan, we've mentioned the strong British connections. Working on the basis of your accent, you're originally from Scotland. How did you end up in Murren?
My sister worked in the Hotel Alpina in Murren in a season, and I said, look, I'll do your job next season. And I convinced Cecil Togvalder at the Alpina to employ a male in service for the first time ever. And it's turned into a very long season.
Right. And so now you're sales manager for the local lift company. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on today. You mentioned you were skiing at the weekend where you opened the final section, and we're going to come to that shortly. But just behind you, I believe, somewhere, is now the world's steepest cable car. Is that right?
Exactly. I've got the steepest cable car right outside the offices. So it's a 2-minute walk across there to a brand new station in Stichelberg that takes you directly up to Murren. It's taking you from 866 meters up to 1641 meters. So that's a difference of 775 meters. And the old cable car used to go via Gimmelwald, and you change in Gimmelwald and then up to Murren, and it took 10 minutes. And this one now is taking under 4 minutes. It's going up at 159.4%. So that means, for those that don't know, for every meter it goes forward, it rises by 1 meter and 59.4 centimeters. And for those that work in degrees, that's almost 60 degrees.
And it's quite hard for me to kind of visualize that. Does it feel a bit strange when you go up it?
The first thing that you'll find strange is that you get in the building in Stichelberg, the brand new building there, which is covered in copper, and the cable car doesn't leave out the side of the building. It leaves and arrives through the roof. So it certainly feels very strange and any steeper, and you're talking about an elevator.
And when did it open, the new lift from Stichelberg?
Stichelberg up to Murren opened on the 14th of December 2024. So we're, what, almost three months been running.
Yeah, at the beginning of this season. So you referred that, you know, that first stage. So this is the first part of a three-stage project. And in Swiss francs, I think it's 130 million or something like that.
Yeah, just over 135 million.
So what are the other stages then? So that first stage, Stichelberg to Murren, that opened in December 2024. Then the next one after that is Murren up to Berg, is that right?
That's correct. And that also opened on 14th of December 2024. So the first of two funifor cableways. Now, a funifor cableway is a cableway where the cables that it's hanging on are as wide or slightly wider than the cable car itself. And this is Switzerland's first ever funifor. So that one's running, and the second one will be installed through the summer and will open in November 2025. We then go up to the top section, which is from Berg to the Schilthorn, and that is the one that we opened on Saturday. In the morning, we went up there and enjoyed the Schilthorn brunch once again for the first time in 5 months.
Remind me what the altitude is at Schilthorn.
So the altitude of the Schilthorn is very easy to remember because it's 1% under 3,000 metres. And if you need to get a calculator out, I'll tell you that's 30 metres off, so it's 2,970 metres.
Right, so you can go now all the way from Stichelberg, 866 metres, up to Schilthorn, 2,970. My research tells me that that's now a 22-minute journey, is that right?
It's 24 minutes according to the Swiss Railways travel plan. But travelling on the cableways from Stichelberg to Murren, it's under 4 minutes. From Murren to Berg, it's 5 minutes. And from Berg to Schilthorn, it's slightly under 5 minutes. So the travel time you're looking at is under 14 minutes. But with all the changes and going through the buildings and to connect with the public transportation system, it's going to take you about 24 minutes.
Well, we won't split a couple of minutes difference. I'm sure if it's timetabled by the Swiss to take 24 minutes, it takes 24 minutes. Just back to that steepest lift. Then the first stage of it. Do you know who it took over that title from?
Definitely, yes. It's poor old Norway have become the second steepest cableway in the world, and it's a place called Loen, and it used to be, or no, it still is, 130-odd percent, and we're heading towards 160%. So,
And it's been open, for some time now. Do passengers ever kind of get nervous on there at all? I mean, I presume no one's going to get on it if they've got vertigo anyway.
I always say you can get people on with vertigo. The trick is to put them in the middle, keep them talking, or let them sit down. And I've seen some people with the old cable car system getting quite nervous. But the best thing you can do is ask them lots of stupid questions, because it takes their mind off of what they're going through. And that's what I always do with people to get them up. But I guarantee there will be some people that will look at that lift and go, I am not getting in that, doesn't matter. No way, Jose.
And of course, one of the great reasons for going up to Schilthorn, listeners might not realise, the links with 007 and James Bond. The movie on Her Majesty's Secret Service was filmed in Murren, I believe, and Blofeld's lair is right, or was filmed right at the top there. There's a fantastic museum I went to a few years ago.
Yeah, well, the book was written by Ian Fleming on Her Majesty's Secret Service, and in the book then Blofeld had a hideout in the Alps, so they sent a location scout called Hubert Frohlich, who I knew 30 years ago because I used to drink in the Hotel Alpina in Murren. And he went through Italy, Austria, France, came into Switzerland and was staying in Grindelwald and was asking where he could do this. And it was 1967, 68. And the Schilthorn had finished building the cableway up to the top, but they were running out of money to finish the building. And so he phoned Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman and said, I think I found the perfect place. And they came over, and that's why the Schilthorn became the James Bond film location for On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which was released in 1969.
And one of the other great things about Schilthorn as well is there's a revolving restaurant at the top there. And I think with in the Jungfrau area, you know, you've got resorts like Grindelwald and Wengen there as well. But I think that Murren is probably the best place for the view of the incredible mountain range there. I don't know if I've got them in the right order, but it's a Munch, Jungfrau and Eiger. Is that right?
Almost. It's the Eiger, Munch and Jungfrau.
There you go. But the view from Murren looking across, it really is the best panorama from there, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, my first season was in 1990, so this year it'll be 35 years I've been in this area. And when I woke up for the first time in the Hotel Alpine and looked out the window and looked across the Eiger North Face, I thought I could live here for a season, and I didn't realise it was going to be a 35-year season so far. But I've looked around the world, and I travel a great deal, and I still am looking for a view that can beat that, and I haven't found it. And I still get excited each and every time I go up in the cable car to the Schilthorn, and it's different every single time. Even after 35 years, I can look sometimes and go, I've never seen that before, which is a wonderful thing to sell, because you're making happy memories to anybody that's going to come here, and I'm sure you can confirm that.
Absolutely. And I think just listening to you there, Alan, I mean, we talked about, you know, how beautiful the Dolomites are. Katia was, you know, had views of Mont Blanc. We all love the mountains, and the Jungfrau is another area where you can just get these incredible views, whether you're going summer or winter. So that's brilliant, Alan. Thanks for bringing us up to date. And I'll put links into the show notes so listeners can work out when they're going to be visiting the world's steepest cable car as well. So that's brilliant, Alan. Thanks very much for that. Let's just move on to feedback now. I enjoy all feedback about the show. Always interested to hear what you think, listener. Please do contact me on social at the Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. A couple of bits of feedback since the last episode. Wells Jones said, I was fascinated by your ski touring adventure on Mount Etna. The descriptions transported me right there amidst the eruptions. It's intriguing how you combine skiing with a unique rail ferry trip in Italy. And Ian Simpson said, we're currently touring in our motorhome and we're inspired by your podcast to visit Valsigny. Well worth it. I managed a day in Bonneville-sur-Arc, which is very different and amazing, especially for those who like off-piste. Keep up the great work. And I thought that was amazing timing, because it was actually Katia who was telling us about Valsigny. There you go, Katia. Your descriptions of Valsigny inspired Ian. There are now 254 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and 128 of those were listened to in the last week. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not go to theskipodcast.com, look around the tags and categories. There is so much in there, you're bound to find something of interest to you. In that last week, Just over half of our listeners were in the UK and the next most in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as Brazil, Romania, and Thailand. Now, if you like the podcast, there are three things you can do to help. You can follow us. Just look for that button, press it now. You can give us a review or leave a comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And you can book your ski hire with InterSportRent using the code SKIPODCAST or taking the link in the show notes. Now, you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at SKIPODCAST. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. And I would like to thank my guest today, Katya. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure to chat to you.
No problem. And Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot too. It's great to be back.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.